listen and silent share the same letters. And if we haven't silenced ourselves, then we can't listen.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality, where this week we're going to be taking a bit of a step back and looking at the data and trends behind our discussions. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Grbowicz. Throughout all these episodes, we've largely been focusing our attention around ideas that came out of our discipleship study. But today we wanted to take a look not just at other studies, but also how people may be able to put these data points into action. John, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Yeah, you know, data is so prized today in our world. I mean, we all know that every single thing that we do and look at on our smartphones gets recorded as a way to identify who we are as customers so that businesses and other entities can give us more services and products. So data is everything, and it means so much to business these days. So what does that mean for the business of the church, so to speak, to have data? This is what this whole survey was really about doing, to really show where people stand and basically how it affirms or maybe challenges some of our assumptions about where people are in their faith journey and their relationship with church. Dave, I know that you've spent so many hours just kind of going through every page of this report. What were some of the things that you thought were just the most interesting or the things that maybe surprised you?
One of the things that surprised me is that people tend to use both physical and digital aids in prayer. I kind of thought there would be a breakdown where, you know, older folks tend to use physical aids like, you know, printed Bibles or what have you, like, you know, spiritual books, and younger people would tend toward app-based experiences like that. But the reality was, I think only 6%, I believe, of respondents said that they only do one or the other. Almost everyone uses both. I found that across generations. I found that interesting. I mean, I mentioned this in our spiritual direction episode, but one of the most surprising findings, just because of the sheer number, 100% of people who have a spiritual director say that it was available in their parish or another faith community to which they belong. Which is to say, when it's available, people do it. Now, as we mentioned in the episode, I think there's probably some people didn't fully understand what we meant by spiritual direction, even though we tried to define it. But, you know, I'm not saying that making things available ensures that people will take advantage of them. But it certainly is the case that if the people don't know where to get something, they're not going to be able to do it. You know, and I think most people are not so motivated to go out and kind of change their spirituality such that they're going to go try to find something that they never even heard of before or don't know how to get it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was surprised to see that we had data behind the fact that prayer apps work in terms of at least getting people to pray. People who pray with prayer apps tend to pray more, or at least more often. Who knows about the quality of the prayer? That's not something we really asked about and probably hard to measure. And that kind of just brings up another thing I want to say is, you know, it's first of all, it's so important to recognize where the Spirit is leading us. You know, we can measure things all day, but ultimately we have to be contemplative enough to hear what God is calling us to do and go there. So there's that. And then also just to try to figure out data-driven means, what is working and what's not. In the interior life, it's so hard to say, like, this is the one thing that, you know, that did this thing. I think everyone's different. I think that it all kind of matters, right? The reason why we have kind of the omni-channel marketing approach in our digital age is because people are getting hit with, I mean, these days, I think people make 6 to 8 touch points with a brand or a product before they make a purchase these days, because they're seeing it on social media, or they might get an email or the website, or, you know, talking to someone, whatever it is, looking up reviews. So there's like a million different kind of inputs. And I think that aspect of culture has pervaded our spiritual life as well, such that it's pretty difficult to kind of pinpoint one thing, right? It's really all of these things. Isn't that kind of what we've been saying all along? It's the integrated life that we're trying to foster, that we're trying to facilitate, right? So it is all of these things.
It is all these things, because the interior life is something that always goes deeper and deeper. And you're just going to be a different part of that journey of how to integrate your interior life with just your lived reality. And certain things are needed at certain times of your life. I always like to say there are certain seasons, right? So seasons, to me, is a good way to look at this. What is the church doing to be able to address certain seasons in people's life? I don't think there's one size fits all, nor should there be. So that's, I think, where things go.
Well, to start, let's take a bit of a look back on the study and talk about what else we might do differently if we ever did something similar in the future. We spoke with Hans Plate, who you may remember from our spiritual direction episode. Hans is the founder and president of Vinia Research, who we partnered with to conduct the study. We talked about what we found surprising from the results and the insights it left us with. So just talking about the study as a whole, you know, whether it's the overall report, the segmentation report, or the additional charts, what were some of the things that you were most surprised by in the findings?
Two things come to mind. One is how many people pray a lot. I forget what the numbers were, but the majority were praying over an hour every day.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was a pretty good prayer. Now I have kids. Now the sample was a little bit older than I am, on average. And so, you know, I have children. I have, two jobs, actually, because I have Vinia and I have Pensari, which is another company I run that does healthcare research still. But anyway, I was I was happy to see that too. You know, I was happy to see that there really are, you know, granted we were going after the high end, the highly engaged, highly practicing Catholic, right?
Right.
And it was nice to see that there was a large segment of them, but it was nice to see that they were, praying a lot, which I think is huge. I think the other thing that surprised me was their stated level of comfort evangelizing or sharing their, you know, the gospel, mm-hmm. and their level of proactivity.
Mm-hmm. What was surprising about it? Because I think it was like 56% were moderately to extremely comfortable. And, oh no, I'm sorry. 76% were moderately extremely comfortable, and something like 56% were moderately extremely proactive, right? Something like right. that.
Which are high numbers. And I guess, you know, thinking about, well, one of the questions that's always on my mind when we finish a study is what would we have done differently? And part of it is just limitations and, you know, survey length and all of that. But I would really want to get into more about what do people mean when they say that they're comfortable doing that and that they're proactive in doing it? What are they doing? Because we also asked the question, how interested are you in learning more about how to evangelize?
Right.
It was really high interest in that as well. I think that's something that would probably be its own study, which is understanding what exactly does it, you know, sharing the faith or sharing the mm-hmm. gospel or witness, whatever, that has so many different meanings and so many practical ways that it can be done. I think a study, you know, really exploring that would be fascinating.
I agree. There's certain things that I would love to be able to follow up on. And, you know, who's to say that we won't? We could maybe one day do something like that, a follow-up study where it goes deeper on a particular issue, potentially, in faith sharing. But part of it also is just my own evolving understanding of the faith, and particularly of evangelization. You know, at the time, you know, the way we defined evangelization certainly came out of, you know, me and conversations I had with you, with others at DeSales, Father John, et cetera. Now, I think that my understanding of it then was probably closer to a position that now I see as a little bit too, holding a little bit too much of an agenda, I guess, mm-hmm. to use that same term we used before. What I mean by that is, and I think people are suspicious of it the same way that we used to use the term proselytization, where it's like, you know, I'm basically coercing people into, you know, quote belief. With evangelization, I think the first thing people think of is missionaries showing up on their doorstep, ready to talk about Jesus. And there's nothing wrong with the heart of a missionary who's doing that. What's wrong is that it puts like everyone else as a project first, even before relationship, right? I don't need to know you. I just need to tell you about my joy for the gospel. It's and I'm putting it that way because I want it to sound like a totally good natured thing, which it is. Like that, those people have every good intention. And I'm sure the the crazy people yelling about Jesus on the subway have that same good intention. But we both know that that's not how anyone comes to know the Lord, right? Not maybe not no one, but by and large, that's not effective. Why is it not effective? Because they haven't entered into a relationship with someone and started dialogue and so forth. And so when we talked about evangelization, I think we had very much like a cut and dry sort of definition in our mind of like, you're evangelizing or you're not. It's kind of on or off, you know, versus, and I'm not trying to, I know that there's a quote that's misattributed to St. Francis of Assisi that, you know, evangelize always when necessary, use words or whatever, yeah, that type of thing. I'm not saying that it's that, but I do think that the posture of being in a relationship with someone and you thinking, I have something you don't have, and I don't need to learn anything from you, or I don't need to see, you know, the Lord showing up in my life through this person who maybe doesn't share the same faith tradition as me. That's a problem. That's totally the wrong posture, I think, for people to have. And I think I had that idea of evangelization in my mind when we wrote the study.
My initial understanding of evangelization as a term revolved around apologetics exclusively. But where I am now is thinking that really to be Catholic is to evangelize in everything that we say and do, in a way. Matthew Kelly, a long time ago, you know, when I came back to the faith, and I was lukewarm and then ultimately came back, and I really consumed everything I could, whether it be Lighthouse Media CDs or books. And apologetics was one of the first themes that I got into. But there was a talk that Matthew Kelly gave once where he basically said that we as Catholics are always, you know, directly and indirectly advertising our faith, you know, that we are human billboards, you know, for the faith. And so that's, you know, that's evangelization. And so it really affects everything that you do. It's your actions and your words. It's more like the baseline. And, you know, we do family faith formation at our parish, and I am a small group leader, and we read really good books and have really good discussions. And it's just becoming increasingly clear. And one of the things I try to share with my group is you can't be Catholic and not evangelize, you know, in a way, right? You have to be constantly, you know, talking to people and bringing more people to the faith. It doesn't mean you're, you know, working to convert people or like, you know, have a soapbox so you can stand up and talk to people about it. But I also have evolved in my thinking of what evangelization is. I mean, so going back to the study, I mentioned how I'd like to know more about what people mean by being proactive and being comfortable, but I'd love to know what got them there. Like how did they develop that level of confidence? Even if it's somewhat overstated, which is possible, they still are comfortable enough to say it. Whereas, you know, I asked my small group, for example, that I just mentioned, and they would say, no, I'm not comfortable. Right. Mm. And these are people that are in family faith formation that are trying, and it's a pretty good group, I think.
Yeah.
But what got them there? That's of course, you know, not the Holy Grail, but it's certainly a, you know, piece of information that a lot of people would love to better understand.
I think we kind of hit on something important. You know, he was quoting Matthew Kelly about how we are always directly and indirectly advertising our faith. It's an important point, right? Because I often think about Mormons. You know, I grew up with a lot of LDS people in high school, and I had a deep respect for them in general. I didn't agree with them, but if you just meet the average Mormon, at least, you know, I know that, you know, there's shows about like the extremes these days, so maybe that's what people think of, but the average Mormon I knew was extremely wholesome person, a very family oriented person. And largely it felt like they were legitimately trying to live the life of the gospel. It felt like they were a close follower of the Lord compared to the average person. And then at least in my case, you start to look into, you know, the doctrine and what they actually believe. And it wasn't credible to me. And so it sort of fell down there. Right. And so when I think about the way a Catholic lives, I feel like the average Catholic is not representing the church all that well. Doesn't necessarily look like they are like trying to live a life that Jesus was modeling. And yet you look at the sort of the beliefs system and so forth, and it's very credible. It's like, wow, this is like extremely well developed. It's an interesting idea, right? Both are necessary, because most people are not going to first start with the church documents or belief system or so forth like that. But that needs to be there too. You need to be able to have these different ways in, and it all needs to kind of resonate.
Yeah. I mean, the most compelling gospel is the one that's lived, right? So, I mean, when you see someone who's living in a way that's genuinely joyful and you sense is authentic, and it doesn't seem to be even very, difficult for them to live in a certain way, because it just seems that they're kind of being their best self, the best version of themselves, as Matthew Kelly would say. Like, I think that's the most compelling gospel. So you're right. I mean, there are a lot of Catholics who pride themselves, I would say, in being able to articulate the teachings of the church, the doctrine of the church, the dogma of the church, and just the intercomplexities of all those things. And a lot of times it doesn't necessarily always translate into a way of living that you would find is genuinely joyful.
I mean, if you're a jerk about that stuff, how's that really gonna be received?
Yeah, I mean, I think once again, it's everyone's on a process here, right? A part of the journey here. I mean, and some people come into an awareness of the gospel through their head, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some people come to it through their heart, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that everyone's just in a different place. I mean, the idea and the reality that everyone we're trying to move to is to be able to be the integrated self, right? To know that there's not an opposition between your heart and your head, and that these both feed each other, and they both affirm the goodness in the other. Because by doing so, you're just becoming more fully yourself, more fully human. And that's why you got to be very careful as to be able to make hard judgments and assessments as to how legitimate one is in practicing the gospel, because they just may be practicing it in a way from a particular perspective that they're only capable of doing as of right now, you know? So it's a journey, right?
Yeah, it is. Our discipleship study deliberately focused on mass attending Catholics, but we also wanted to get a look at the trends at play outside of that group. To help us with that, we spoke with Josh Packard, the co-founder of Future of Faith and previously the director of Springtide Institute for Research. His organization provides custom research for different faith communities. We spoke about the problems organizations are facing in an increasingly irreligious world.
Has your research revealed, like, what are young people's images of God? Like, who are they praying to? Is it more of just like an awareness of self? I mean, like, have you got into those types of ways to understand what prayer means and what they think they're accomplishing with prayer? I mean, because I understand what you're saying. I mean, like,
yeah,
if you're spiritually minded, it's not like you don't believe in anything. It's like you believe in you believe in anything, right? Like, you know, you could believe in anything at that point. And I think, like, and honestly, I just want to kind of say too, like, I think that's all really good. Like, I don't get all freaked out when people are into astrology or crystals or things like that. I think that that's all really interesting, because I think it's actually leading us even more into an incarnational worldview, that things actually have value beyond what they just appear to be. That the things are, signs are important. I mean, like, sacramentals are signs, actually. I mean, they are realities, but they're also signs of those realities to get to them. So, like, I think that's all really good stuff. I don't think it's like, I don't think we should be making judgments on what young people are doing necessarily. I mean, yeah, if someone's intentionally doing something harmful, that,
well, sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's different. But I mean, like, but what have you found to be, because, like, honestly, I don't even know my own students really what their full image of God is. I mean, I get some awareness from some students, but it is a little ambiguous, because when you throw out, like, okay, I don't ascribe to, like, an institutional image of God, let's say, then what do you fill that with? Or, like, what is it, you know?
Well, I think this is a massively important question right now, actually. And it's one that we are at the Future of Faith. We have just finished the first part of what will be a long-term study about the intersection between listening and faith formation. And those results will be out in January. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're starting to turn our attention to is exactly this question, which is, what is God now? And, you know, it's been 25 years since the National Study of Youth and Religion that Christian Smith led out of Notre Dame, that came up with this phrase, moralistic therapeutic deism, to describe how young people think about God. God is this moral arbiter, essentially, that he's therapeutic. He will solve your problems. And it's a deist, like there is a God, a singular God. That has always been a problematic characterization of young people. It is even more so now, even though I don't want to diminish its utility because it did a great service, but it always had limits. I would say that those limits have only been augmented in the last 20 years as the world has gotten more diverse. The idea of capturing the most diverse generation in the history of America with three words is preposterous now. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. And so what we need is something that's a little bit more process-based, I think, understanding and capturing the various ways that young people are making sense of and encountering the divine in their lives, and sometimes encountering it, but dismissing it, not having language for it. In other ways, like ascribing it to something that probably isn't divine. Like, I don't think Taylor Swift is a god, even though Taylor Swift is very, very important to lots of young people, and her music is very important to lots of young people. So I think that the time is right to try and understand that again. It's one of the things that we're going to be turning our attention to, because you're right to say, like, hold on, I'm not sure we're all talking about the same thing anymore, if we ever were. It's just that I think less and less, to a point that is now just pretty clear that we're coming at this with a lot of different perspectives. And also the really critical thing to remember about being a teenager is that, you know, what you liked at 13 wasn't what you liked at 18, and what, you know, what you liked at 18 or what you wanted to be when you grew up or all this, that's not what you were at 38, you know, or 48. So like a heavy dash of, you know, hang on a second, this is all being negotiated in real time.
What do you think the unique needs are when it comes to what, you know, ministering to Gen Z? And I ask that, I want to ask that through the lens of, are more young people than ever before disaffiliating from the institutional church, in part because what the church thinks they need and what they need is so different? Or is it that the need has become so removed from what, let's say, traditions offer, that it's not even possible for a church to meet some of those needs? Or is that just a perception? Mm.
Well, let's be really clear about one thing. Young people are not leaving the church. Their parents are. And in many cases, their parents left the church. So like I had a priest, actually, a presentation I was giving, a webinar. He said, you know, what can we do to get these young people, you know, to get these young people back? This is a couple of years ago. Like, that's a great question to ask like 15 years ago.
Yeah, no, you're right. I said disaffiliated. Sure. I should have said unaffiliated. Yeah.
But it's not like, Dave, I'm not picking on you at all. Like, I understand that's the common language, but like the implication for a lot of people there is that they are, I think the church really is that far behind.
Yeah.
On this trend that they.
No, think, you're right. You're right. I went to London. I went to a conference in London. Sorry to cut you off, but just, you know, I just to kind of see what the future's like, you know, essentially, you know, they're so much further down that they're now talking about, you know, when we talk about the, you know, this apostolic mission that we're on, because the, you know, you can't assume that someone has a Christendom worldview anymore. They're assuming that they're talking to someone who maybe has never met a Christian. It is likely now to meet a person who's never met a Christian when you meet someone just in London, let's say. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah.
And I totally found the last time I taught, well, every time I taught sociology of religion, we would try and go on field trips. I'd try and take them to a Catholic church and to a mosque if I could, a synagogue and a Protestant church. And the last time I did that in 2018, 2019, right before the pandemic, when I was teaching that class the last time, it was over half of my students who had never, at least in their, maybe they had been when they were baptized or something, but they could not recall having been in any house of worship. So it used to not be uncommon at all for this, you know, to have never been in a synagogue or a mosque. I mean, statistically speaking, just not uncommon. But the idea, I was stunned that half of my students at, now it's not a private school, it's a state school, but they're signing up for a sociology of religion class. And like, I've never been in a Catholic church before. I've never been in a, you know, in a Protestant church. Like, holy cow. they don't even know what the architecture looks like. You know, like that it's a years ago when Target flipped their layout, I got really confused. Like, I can't even imagine how disorienting it must be to walk, you know, to think about walking through the doors of a place that only exists in your head in movies and TV shows.
Well, I mean, that was profoundly insightful. I mean, this is something that I clearly resonate with as a high school teacher. Really, what are we talking about when we're talking about God and the church? I think Josh has done such exceptional work in being able to present to educators and people who are in church ministry the real raw data of what's happening on the ground with young people. And I would also say too that this is a really exciting time to be doing church, so to speak, because you get to create something from scratch as to how to respond to maybe the deeper desires of people who've never explored those desires in any type of meaningful way. So it's like a golden opportunity right now. And the worst thing to do is somehow to just think that we can do what we've been doing, let's just say in the mid 20th century, and give it to people who are in this place where they're really genuinely spiritually seeking, although they have no frame of reference when it comes to, say, a traditional understandings of God and church. You can't give them something that they're not looking for. You have to give them what they are looking for, which is far greater than whatever the, let's just say, the institution can offer from infrastructure levels or programming.
Yeah, we can't just assume that whatever the church it looks like and is being presented as is good enough, right? Like, it, yes, is the Holy Spirit always guiding the church? Yes. But is it up to the people of God who are the church to make it welcoming in a way that actually meets people? I started to cut myself off because this phrase is so overused, meeting people where they are. But I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, the things that the institutional church offers, it's almost like when good innovation happens, and I'm not talking about incremental innovation, but real large scale invention innovation. When that type of stuff happens, you could do focus groups all day and you're not going to hear those ideas come out because people don't realize what they need. I wonder if it's a little bit similar where the institutional church stuff, like the sacraments that are real needs, are not perceived needs. You know, someone who has no understanding of Christianity is never going to say to themselves, man, I really need the Eucharist today. Like that's right. Never going to occur to someone.
Right.
What they do know they need is community, belonging, like something more beyond the human or the material or something like that. Those are the types of things. And those are the things that you could say the institutional church offers, but the reality is it's what the people of the church are here to offer. And then, right. And then we've got the institutional church, like when you're ready, but those aren't the ways in, you know, typically we've talked about this.
Yeah. I mean, nothing more compelling than the lived gospel, you know, someone living the gospel. Yep. But it's interesting because I think a lot of times we feel as if we can just wow people with, like, say, the liturgy. Like, they'll come into a place where, Jesus, this building is unlike anything else, and this celebration is so reverent and mysterious that clearly it draws me into, if anything, learning more about it. I'm not saying that's not possible. I think that's totally possible, but it's not the only way that it would somehow work, because to get someone into the doors is not the easiest thing to do, first off. And secondly, it's not gonna hit every single person that way who walks through the doors. So there needs to be a space and room to know that people who have had an experience of God, who consider themselves to be part of the church, have to kind of be able to live that experience in a way that invites people in to helping them discern the deeper things of their soul and maybe what it is that they are seeking that they maybe cannot articulate.
Yeah. And sometimes we can just take it as a blessing that we're starting from scratch, you know, because if you're starting from scratch, that means yeah. you're not starting from like someone who's got baggage from the sex scandal or anything totally. Else.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think there is some baggage from that, to tell the truth, but I agree that there is, there's not the same type of baggage.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't mean like someone who actually lived through it and has some kind of, is a victim or something like that. That's awful. And obviously that person has their own thing. I'm thinking more just people who are aware of the terrible publicity given the church for this reason. And someone who's, and so now like just a regular Christian sort of has to like outlive that
right.
You have to actually make such an impression on someone that they're like, whoa, not only does this person trust that institution that is known for doing that bad thing, but they actually are pretty cool. Maybe that thing is not as pervasively all-encompassing as I thought it would be.
Yeah. I still think bad press coverage of the church still kind of taints people's impression of, say, the Catholic Church. When I think about the baggage stuff, though, I think like there's not as many people that I know of who are younger who have the baggage of like guilt, for example. Like when I was growing up, everything I did was wrong. I feel guilty for thinking things and acting a certain way, and you know, so the guilt
angry
stuff.
Father God, yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot of that with younger people, at least that I've come across. The angry God, the feeling guilty about everything, and that's like very big big baggage you have to somewhat work with and undo, because that stuff sticks really hard when people have gone through that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely in your camp on that one. Unfortunately, somewhat separate from these more formal studies, there's already been an initiative in the church to take a deeper look at the needs of the faithful. And of course, I'm speaking about the Synod on Synodality, which of course, Pope Francis, before his death, called for an extra 3 years plus of, right? And so this is an ongoing thing. We spoke with Father Joe Gibino, the Vicar of Evangelization for the Diocese of Brooklyn, and a number of other things, and also the pastor of St. Charles Borromeo Church, about his experiences with the Synod on Synodality at the diocesan level in Brooklyn. In these interviews that we've been doing for the podcast, we've been hearing over and over the importance of genuine listening and all the different levels. How much have you experienced of this as a pastor, and does it reflect what you saw in the Synod? You know, was there genuine listening happening? Yeah, what was that like?
I will say this, Bishop Brennan was genuinely listening to what the people of God had to say to him as their bishop. And he took that to heart and really made that a focus. So much so that after the 22 deaneries met, we collated their deanery reports. We brought them back to the Diocesan Pastoral Council. He attends most of those meetings. When he can, he is there listening to what the council has to say. Also, he then revisited all 22 of the deaneries to go through their reports with leadership. And now we're starting another round of listening. So from his standpoint, definitely, he is putting a lot of time and energy into listening to the people. The leadership of the Synod, listen. Getting the people of God to be patient with one another and listen, they genuinely tried. But as all of the human condition, sometimes it gets difficult. And that's always inviting people to silence. One of the things I like to remind people, listen and silent share the same letters. And if we haven't silenced ourselves, then we can't listen. So one of the challenges of the Synod was getting all of the voices to be quiet and just silent. Then we can listen. So that's been a challenge, in all honesty.
Do you personally cultivate a practice of silence in some way in your life?
Oh, I definitely do. I try and tune everything out for a very quiet hour of prayer or spiritual reading every day. Just no noise, nothing. I'm hidden in a corner of my room and just try to block it out. Because once the day starts, here in downtown Brooklyn, I had to find a place where I couldn't hear jackhammers this morning to do this podcast. There's noise all around us all the time.
Mm-hmm. And what are the fruits of good listening? You know, do you think that the what we heard from the synod will actually end up, you know, producing something, or is it just, or was the process itself the point?
The process itself was extremely important because it's journey, and process is always a journey. And Pope Francis wanted us to reflect on what it means for us to walk together. And when the disciples walked with Jesus, he told them parables about the kingdom. And in order to truly understand a parable, we have to listen and then take it to our hearts. And then the early church gave us the same model to grow in our journey with the Lord. So the fruit of good listening is the Holy Spirit. Because until we drown out all the other voices, how can we hear the authentic voice of the Spirit?
Yeah.
And, you know, doing the great example from the Old Testament, the voice of the Spirit was not an earthquake. It wasn't in howling wind. It was the gentle whispering breeze. Same for us. All the noise drowns out the gentle whispering breeze of the Spirit.
I wonder if people were changed in some way, coming into contact in maybe a new way with one another in the process of the synod. You know, people of a parish who maybe they talk regularly with one another, they hang out after Mass, or maybe they don't. Maybe they're people who regularly just head home. But they're now engaging in serious discussions about what's needed in the church. Do you think that that changed, you know, the community of parishes in any substantial way?
We're hoping, because coming from the West Coast, I grew up in California, and I came here after graduate studies. And one of the things I noticed right away was self-identification. I self-identify with St. Charles Borromeo Parish, not my neighborhood, but my parish. We now have to ask people to self-identify as the Catholic community of Brooklyn Heights, not so much just St. Charles Borromeo Parish, but we are Catholic in Brooklyn Heights. That's a big mindset alteration here in the East. And this process began that, because we're asking people to step out of a comfort zone of we've always done it this way into we need to gather together to form a new community of faith. Mm-hmm. And that is huge. And we're running into all now of the, well, how do we do that? The nuts and bolts. So I've always gone to the 4 o'clock Mass. I'm a 4 o'clock Mass goer. And if you don't have 4 o'clock Mass, I'm going to find one. Mm. Well, that's very different than saying we as a community come together to share the Eucharist. Mm. And that's what we're working on right now.
Does that require more cooperation and collaboration between pastors of a certain area and maybe even their leadership teams and others kind of in leadership roles in the parishes?
Absolutely. And in this sense, what, as the vicar of evangelization and catechesis, I hope to be able to help parishes see family ministry, family catechesis, as a way of uniting neighborhoods, and also as the meaning of journey together as family. Until we journey together as families, we can't journey together as a family of God. So that emphasis on family catechesis, family evangelization, then allows whole families to go out and evangelize.
We did the discipleship study in order to try to not trust ourselves, but to use data to tell us what the unmet needs of Catholic Mass attenders are and to understand what the journey looks like for them. As far as I understand, Pope Francis called the Synod on Synodality as a way of getting people to listen to one another without needing to have the bishops convene. So as a way of extending extending the spirit of Vatican II to the laity in a real way at every level of the church. And so the goals were not exactly the same, but some of the same themes did come up. And so in a way, you know, what was similar was in both cases, we heard from mass attending Catholics about what's on their mind when it comes to their spirituality. And I know that the synod was trying to reach the margins because that was always Pope Francis's kind of vision. But the reality was, you know, how many people who weren't mass attending Catholics were really going to be able to speak into this? who is even going to hear about what, you know, when they could be talking, voice their thing. So anyway, so we heard from, I think that both heard from a similar group and both heard similar things that we need to be focusing. I think the key themes that I heard from the synod are a need for formation, a need to focus on youth, a need for better communication. And we certainly heard formation and communication over and over in different ways in our study as well. So there's definitely similarities there. What was your takeaway from the Synod on Synodality, John? And what are your hopes for kind of this next iteration of it?
Yeah, you know, I have to admit, I wasn't following everything that closely. I mean, it clearly has caused so much controversy, the whole Synod on Synodality. I mean, there's, I guess you would say, a more traditional conservative wing of the church that's highly suspicious of it because it feels as if it's just kind of doing a lot of nonsense in some ways, because it's just having people talk about things that the church can't change because of just how dogma and doctrine is defined. So, you know, why are we setting people up for failure, so to speak, because there's things that just can't change. And to talk about them is not really helpful. It in some ways undermines even just the permanence of the doctrine itself. So there's a lot of that. There's also, I think, a lot of criticism because people feel as if only certain voices are being heard and other voices are not being heard. So that's another big thing that we start to hear. So maybe more progressive voices are given more of a platform to say things, and more traditional voices are not given that the same equal time. So there's a lot of issues in that way too. But, you know, I think there's also criticism that comes from people on the more progressive side of things too, because they feel as if, well, we're saying a lot and we're really kind of pushing for certain things to be heard, but really nothing changes. So it's almost a setup for like no one actually looking at it as being helpful, because no one's really kind of getting what they want. Everyone is feeling suspicious of other voices. There's this sense that somehow the church is being undermined, or at least the dogma and doctrine of the church is being undermined. So there's a lot of stuff going on. If we can just get it to a place that, you know, everything is about some form of wrestling, so that we are able to allow the church to say what the church is and teaches in the most clear and relevant way for our time, I think that would be maybe the best way of looking at this. I would like to think that's exactly what the Second Vatican Council was doing. I think that maybe we didn't really explicitly call it a synodal experience, which led to the rise of Vatican II, but it seems to me that there was enough of people within, say, the church structure who were listening to the so-called signs of the times, you know, that something had to be represented or be able to be renewed so that it made more relevance and more sense to people in the 20th century and beyond. I think that's what was the Spirit was doing. I think that the Spirit was doing a lot more too with the council. So, you know, I think if we look at the Synod on Synodality as really just an extension of the Second Vatican Council, I think that might be the best way to look at it, because the council wasn't necessarily concerned about we need to kind of change or update doctrine and dogma. It was more about like, how do we make this message more relevant? And I think people, when they hear that, they think that somehow means we're going to be watering down things or somehow making it more akin to just like, being very temporary, kind of just trendy types of things. I don't really see it that way. I think there's a way to be able to do this where you are able to take things that are timeless, things that have been articulated and also just talked about for ages throughout the history of the church, and just be able to make it more relevant. I know I'm saying a lot right now, but it's I think it's such a very potent topic. So
no, I see it exactly like you do as continuity from Vatican II. I think, you know, what I would respond to from to kind of both sides of the aisle, so to speak, is to traditionalists, first of all, isn't it useful to hear what's on people's minds? You know, regardless of how changeable or not changeable something is, it's pretty instructive if this is where people are. And second, you know, doctrine does develop over time, and no doctrine ever becomes, you know, doctrine or dogma if it's not first on the hearts of the community of the faithful in general, right? For years and years. This is how things work. I granted, previous to this, it was never about the laity. It was always what's on the hearts of bishops, essentially. But, you know, I hope they were doing a good job of listening to people in their regions. And if they weren't, well, this is a good exposure to maybe what wasn't being heard, you know, previously.
Yeah.
To the more liberal or progressive side, I would say, look, if this wasn't enough for you, well, it was a lot. You know, like these, what seems like small changes at the time are actually pretty big strides. Just as a case in point, if you want to know just how revolutionary, reading Vatican II now, if you are kind of familiar with the church in the 20th and 21st century, it doesn't feel very radical. You know, these documents feel like they are, you know, they're like, oh yeah, this is exactly how the church, this, especially someone like me or you, John, who grew up well after the council was over and, you know, the liturgical reforms had already happened, all that kind of stuff. If you look at the main document of Vatican I, Pater Aeternus, just the tone alone shows you how much had truly changed in terms of the church's posture and how it was listening to the rest of the world, responding to the rest of the world. Every section in the Vatican I document is like, and if someone disagrees with this, let him be anathema. Let him be anathema.
right.
That is, yeah. Nowhere in Vatican II do you see that. I mean, it's a profound change. And so actually, if you think about what's really happening with the synod, it is a profound change again, 60 years later.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing things this way, just simply because, like, I mean, I just really believe that the truth of God's love always prevails in and through every situation. I have to believe that. It's what makes me a person of hope, right? I mean, we're all called to be people of hope. I mean, what could possibly happen in this whole process that's going to lead to the utter collapse of God's love? It's just impossible. It's just simply impossible. I mean, now I understand that, you know, people feel like, well, there's collateral damage that happens in these things. And that is true. And we have to be mindful of who gets affected and how they get hurt in the process. And but I feel that, like, you know, that's, if we are able to kind of keep that at front and center as well, we can take the risks that we have to take when it comes to listening to people and their experience, while at the same time being very present to those who may be affected by the risks that others are taking in that same process. It's, I think, what we're called to do.
Agreed. I think that's going to do it for us on this episode of Religion to Reality. We hope you learned as much from these interviews as we did, and maybe you'll think about church data a little differently going forward. Maybe you've been convinced, as I am, of how important it is to discuss our interpretations of the data, given how many different insights we can leap to just from a change in the context. And I hope that you find this podcast in some small way accompanying you on the journey, just as the Synod on Synodality was meant to do. Thanks again to our guests today, Hans Plate, Josh Packard, and Father Joseph Jabino. You can learn more about Hans' work at Vinea Research, that's V-I-N-E-A research.com. Josh Packard can be found at futureoffaith.org, and everything about the Synod can be found at synod.va/en. We hope you join us again next week for the final episode of this first season of Religion to Reality, as we try to tie it all together and look at how we can really begin to live an integrated life. Once again, I'm your host, Dave Plisky, joined by my friend and co-host, John Gribowich, and we hope to see you again next time. Religion to Reality is an initiative of DeSales Media created by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Connor Donnelly. If you found value in our conversation, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you love the show, ratings and reviews go a long way toward letting others know about the show. Go to religiontoreality.org for more details and resources. And if you are ready to take the next step and join in community with us, check out the Called Learning Community, co-founded by Father John Gribowich. Go to calledcommunity.com to sign up for our free online gatherings.